is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In Trump's Washington, reality seems to have conformed itself to the 24-hour cable news cycle. The Supreme Court ruling yesterday against the public sector unions would normally lead the news for days, but tied with the retirement announcement by Justice Anthony Kennedy, the swing vote on a closely divided court for years has thrown into question whether Roe v. Wade, the Obergefell decision on gay marriage, and scores of others will be overturned in the next few years. And that's just yesterday. Remember back a few days, a few weeks? Immigration and border policies, tariffs on our longtime allies, as well as our competitors, not to mention the summit with Kim Jong-un, were all-consuming. To provide some context beyond the 24-hour boundaries, we are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and University of Cincinnati political scientist David Niven. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Ken, David, welcome to Cincinnati Edition. Welcome back in both cases.
So, thank you so much. I wish we had something to talk about.
I know. How are we going to fill this? Well, let's get started with the Supreme Court. You know, the resignation yesterday of Justice Kennedy has been just what President Trump has been waiting for, promising his base, the evangelical and Roman Catholic base, that he would appoint somebody who is going to reverse the Roe versus Wade decision. I think he's used the term almost immediately. How do you think the nomination process will play out in the Senate? You know, what about Susan Collins, a Republican of Maine, Lisa Murkowski, a Republican of Alaska? How are they going to play this? By the way, I have made a big mistake here. Ken, you've got a question for us, a trivia question, which I
was wondering what's going on here.
I'm so anxious to get to the to the Supreme Court. But you have a question for us. I'm even hoping that it might have something to do with the Supreme Court to set us up.
Well, it does. But I was listening to you knowing that you were forgetting the trivia question, but understanding it completely because this is such, I mean, for a political junkie, this is an amazing week and so many imponderables, especially with the fact that the midterm elections are coming up and how the Supreme Court calculations affected it. But agree with you. We start with the trivia question, which is Supreme Court related.
Ah, good.
And it's not as difficult as people might think. But the trivia question is, who was the last successful Supreme Court nominee? Successful nominee whom both of Ohio's senators voted against.
So had to be successful. That person, he or she, had to make it to the court, but both Ohio senators voted against them.
Right. So when I say so, it's successful. So not like a Robert Bork or a Clement Haynesworth or somebody like that. Somebody who was actually on the court.
Okay. We don't have Howard here, but David, you know, can write down his idea, and we'll check out to see if he's right. Remember, people who want to call in on that question, call 513-419-7100. Now let's get back to today's news, and Ken. What position does this put Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski in?
Well, that's a great, there's so many great questions here. The question here, these are obviously, look, the Republicans control the Senate 51-49, but it's actually 50-49 because John McCain is very unlikely to return for the vote. He's very ill in Arizona, and he's unlikely to vote. So it's 50-49. And so one Republican, even though it's a Republican Senate, one Republican could theoretically block a Trump Supreme Court nominee. And we focus on Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, the Republican Senate from Maine and Alaska, because they're both pro-choice female Republicans. And so with the thought of Roe versus Wade hanging in the balance, with women's rights hanging in the balance, there'd be a lot of pressure on Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. Now, having said that, they both have voted for Republican judges in the past who have been pro-life, so they are not completely wedded to pro voting against the pro-life judge nominee. Now, neither one one. Neither Collins nor Murkowski is up in 2018, but some Democrats, there are 10 Democrats who were elected, who are running for re-election in states won by Donald Trump, especially people like Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Joe Donnelly in Indiana. There's going to be tremendous pressure on them from conservatives saying, if you vote against Trump, Trump's nominee in these very pro-Trump states, your re-election could be in jeopardy in November. So there's pressure not only on Murkowski and Collins on the Republican side, there's a lot of pressure on Democrats to go along with their conservative constituents, as I say, on the Democratic side.
David, you know, when Senate hearings are held and candidates come forward, when these questions are asked, they usually try to skirt them. But it's going to be pretty difficult because the president has promised that the nominee will help roll back Roe versus Wade to begin with. So, you know, that really puts everybody on a difficult path here.
Well, you're right. They do try and skirt every question of substance put to them. You know, Roberts famously said, I'm just an umpire. I don't have any opinions on these things. And, of course, Clarence Thomas made the incredible claim to have never even discussed, you know, major issues like abortion in his entire life. But I think Ken is right that, you know, Collins and Murkowski are intriguing cases. And though they've voted for very conservative judges in the past, they've never voted for that fifth vote to overturn Roe. So this could be very different. But the larger issue for Democrats, as much as they may invest hope that Collins or Murkowski or someone of that ilk might not support the nominee, is, as Ken said, how many Democrats will defect? And Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota yesterday put out a statement saying, with regard to McConnell having, you know, denied Obama a vote on his nominee, Heitkamp's statement was, two wrongs don't make a right. As in, you know, let's not play games with the next nominee. And two wrongs don't make a right was something my first grade teacher, Mrs. Elker, used to say all the time. And, you know, it really encapsulates the problem for Democrats. If two wrongs don't make a right and the other side is going to do wrongs, then you're going to lose if you follow that philosophy.
So, you know, I see in terms of the midterms, there's two ways of posing this. You know, what happens if an anti-abortion candidate is approved before November? What does that do? And then the other side is, if the Republicans can't get a nominee through before November, what does that do to their Senate candidates? I think both sides have something at stake here.
Well, I think you're right that it really is a motivation question. You know, in terms of the election, probably the best case scenario for Democrats is they lose this fight. Someone severely conservative, as Mitt Romney would say, is put on the court, and then they can point to dramatic events befalling, you know, their core beliefs, and use that to motivate voters. On the Republican side, getting that nominee through, you know, is a positive that, you know, they'll begin celebrating and maybe reduces some of the imperative to act. But if the nominee, you know, should be stalled at all, again, fuel to the fire of the Republican base.
Ken, what do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, you think of how what kind of a president Donald Trump has been, and you talk about a very scant record in Congress. Obviously, the Republicans can't get their act together on immigration and taxes and the environment and infrastructure and things like that. But the fact is that here's the thing, though. When you replaced Antonin Scalia with Neil Gorsuch, basically you got a push. You replaced a strong conservative with a strong conservative. If you replace Anthony Kennedy, who has voted for abortion rights and gay rights and certain liberal issues, if you replace him with a far right, a hard right conservative, that, you know, the Democrats can say, well, maybe they have an issue in November, but the fact is you'll have a Supreme Court with a conservative majority putting Roe in jeopardy for perhaps forever, putting women's rights in jeopardy, gay rights in jeopardy. It is It is just one of those pivotal moments in American history, I think, then where the vote is so crucial, will be so closely watched. I mean, Bork, as conservative as Robert Bork was, I mean, we knew at the end that his nomination in 1987 by President Reagan was doomed from the start. He was very, very controversial. And even many Republicans, John Warner, people like that, would still vote against him. But this one is you know, 50-50. And as, you know, as David said, if this is going to determine where the court goes on so many of these 5-4 decisions, this is just going to be one we're going to be watching so close. And it's interesting, Merrick Garland, I mean, poor Merrick Garland, the fact that he was, had he been approved, you know, nominated and approved by the Senate in 2016, my goodness, so many of these recent issues on abortion and labor rights and the travel ban and all those things, that would have been different. But I guess woulda, shoulda, coulda, right?
Well, I mean, you're looking at the most significant political heist, certainly, you know, of the last century. That you put Garland on the court, and the entire, you know, the entire substance of the court's year is upended. And you know, I agree that the Kennedy, you know, replacing Kennedy with another Gorsuch, another Alito is a major move. But I mean, the real bottom line is you replaced Garland with Gorsuch, and that's transformative. And you know, one of the things that fascinates me here is, think about this: the Republicans have had the Supreme Court, a majority of the Supreme Court seats, since 1970. They have an almost perpetual hold on the Supreme Court. All the while doing that, you know, while they've lost 6 out of the last 7 popular votes for the presidency, it's really quite a spectacular run for the one branch of government that actually still seems to function.
Well, I want to.
Well, I was just going to say, you remember that slogan that was used by the Gore campaign and NARAL in 2000? It's the Supreme Court, stupid. Basically, that's expression is more important than ever. And my goodness, there is so much pressure on Ruth Bader Ginsburg
to be
taking daily vitamins and doing her exercises and staying on as long as she can, certainly from liberals.
Well, you see the liberals online offering her a kidney if she should happen to need one. And
right. Well, she needs it or not.
But I think that does raise a question about just, does she want to stay if the Republicans are able to fill this with a very conservative judge and there's no longer any question where the 5-4 votes split goes, you know, how long is she going to want to stay around? I mean, it's not a lot of fun to always be in dissent. Yeah, so
it's kind of ghoulish to talk about her life expectancy, and of course she has had cancer and health issues. But that's why so many liberals, rightly or wrongly, were putting so much pressure on her while Barack Obama was still in the White House, saying, "You're getting up there in age. We need to keep this liberal seat. Maybe you should step down." And she would say, "How dare you tell me to step down? I'm here for a life appointment. I'm not going anywhere." But of course, you know, sometimes God may have other plans.
Wow. Okay. Ken, before we break, read your question one more time so people can think and they have a chance to call in.
The last successful Supreme Court nominee whom both of Ohio senators voted against.
Okay. Does the answer have to include the senators or just the nominee?
I will give them a personal shout out if they name the senators, but I think basically, if you know the nominee, then you'll know the senators.
The outcry, both nationally and internationally, against the policy of separating children and parents at the border caused an unusual response from President Trump. He modified his policy in the face of popular opinion. But that policy and others provide an uncommon amount of fuel for Democratic candidates in the midterm election. In New York City, a Democratic socialist knocked off the number 4 leader of the Democratic Party in the U.S. House. To explore partisan prospects for the midterms and other issues, we are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and UC political scientist David Niven to join our discussion and also to answer Ken's trivia question. You can call 513-419-7100. So, Ken, we've had your question twice. I think we've got a lineup now of callers, and I'm going to start with Lynn. Lynn, do you think you know who that last person was that both Ohio senators voted against?
I'm going to take a shot. William Howard Taft.
William Howard Taft, an Ohioan. Ken?
Yeah.
I can't imagine William Howard Taft being opposed by Ohio senators, but I'm talking about much more recent than that.
Okay, so not that one. And, okay.
Did you know I went to William Howard Taft High School in the Bronx? I think America should know that.
Okay, I think America should know that.
Matter of fact, when I went to William Howard Taft High School, Taft was still president. That's even more remarkable.
John, I think you have an answer. Let's see if you've got it.
I was going for Clarence Thomas.
Clarence Thomas.
Well, Clarence Thomas is not only a good guess, it is the correct guess, and it makes complete sense. Because that was he barely in 1991 he barely was nominated was approved confirmed by the Senate and of course back then the two Ohio senators were John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum, and so that made sense completely that they would vote against a very conservative justice like Clarence Thomas. So John is absolutely correct.
So, John, hang on, and we'll get all your information and make sure that you get a coveted Ken Rudin political junkie button. So, moving along here, domestic politics this week. How significant is it that in the face of popular outcry, President Trump modified this policy of family separation? It's the policy's one thing, but the fact, usually President Trump's instinct is to double down when he's challenged. Here he did pull back a bit. So, David, what do you think about that?
You know, I think it's an excellent example of the difference between an abstract issue and a vivid issue. You know, abstractly, people might object to immigration policies that are in place now. But when you see and when you hear, you know, children being ripped away from parents and children, you know, literally locked up in a Walmart, you know, in this kind of dystopian view of what the nation's become, it's just intolerable to people. You know, it's the same magic of the civil rights movement of the 60s. Jim Crow was acceptable to the North from a distance, you know, for generations. But when you saw the pictures, when you saw Bull Connor let loose, people were outraged. And so I think that the failure of the Trump administration was just, you know, a basic understanding that you can't let people know, you can't let people see pain like this. And so, you know, this was, you know, in a cynical political sense, this was a great gift to the Democratic Party that this was so open and they had to stop it lest this be the issue in November, which is certainly not going to serve the Republicans well.
Ken, what do you think about that? Do you think it says a lot, much about President Trump?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. First of all, the last thing, I smiled when David said the last thing because he said it gave a great gift to the Democratic Party. This was a gift that lasted all of 2 days, it seems like. Like once upon a time, the Trump administration was reeling on all those horrific pictures of children crying and stranded and separated from their families, and the Republicans were reeling and on the ropes, and the Democrats were getting advantage, and then suddenly the courts rule on the travel ban. Anthony Kennedy steps down, and suddenly the Republicans have that advantage. But let me say one thing. Dan, when you gave that description, the introduction, the beginning, you said, usually, when the president is in a box in the corner, he doubles down. But this time, he didn't. Actually, I think he did. First of all, let me just say that for the longest time, he was saying the policy of separating children from their families who were coming into the country illegally was the Democrats' idea. This was all the Democrats' idea. Then, at the same time, Jeff Sessions and the president said, this is a great policy. This zero tolerance is a great policy. So for one, at the same time they were blaming Democrats, they were saying, we support this policy completely. But then, as David was saying, when you saw those horrific pictures, the president signed the executive order, which he, of course, for the longest time said he couldn't do, but he did it, and suddenly that ended. But even as he did that, he still doubled down on tremendous anti-immigration rhetoric. He talked about sending back people as soon as they get here without due process, which I think the Supreme Court would have a field day or at least the old Supreme
Court maybe.
Would have a field. Exactly right. Who knows anymore? But I mean, so for all the talk about Trump really, you know, seeing the light and backing down, I don't even think he did that, except for the fact that the executive order of separating children from their families, that's going away. But look what happened in the House yesterday when say, okay, we're going to have a great policy. The Republican leadership, Paul Ryan and company, have been talking about changing these the immigration policy, and they spent weeks and weeks in working on it, and it got clobbered. Not only did every Democrat there vote against it, but half the Republican Party did as well. So Democrats voted against it because it was cruel. Republicans voted against it because they thought it was amnesty for the Dreamers. The Republican Party still has a serious, serious problem and divisions over immigration that doesn't look like it's going to go away anytime soon.
David, given the failure of those two measures, those two proposals in Congress this week, is this just dead until after the election, at least?
Well, I think it's a good bet. I mean, take any issue and put your money on it's dead. The House Republican Caucus is not a functioning entity. So, you know, just start with that as a fact that these folks, you know, the right hand doesn't approve of what the far right hand is up to and vice versa. You know, that's your starting point. And now imagine something got through the House. Now it's going to get through the Senate, you know, through filibusters and everything. It's basically impossible. And that's why I say when we started the show, why are we paying attention to the Supreme Court? Because it actually does things. It does big consequential things, and it refuses to stop. It doesn't shut down. It doesn't have factions within itself that then stop all the decision making. You know, you've got a Supreme Court majority working. You're getting decisions.
Well,
and you know, one more thing about the House vote, which is so fascinating to me. Earlier in the week, or last week, it was the president tweeted, "The Republicans should not waste their time dealing with immigration. Let's wait till we gain more House and Senate seats in November, and then we'll bring it up. Let's not waste time." And then at the end, so he sent a signal to the House Republicans saying, don't even bother working on this at all. And then at the last second, he said, you got to vote yes on this. It's very, very important. So there was such mixed feelings coming out of the White House. There was no direction from Trump at all. And I think that the Republicans were really kind of left just floundering and just, you know, wandering in the desert on this.
What does that tell you, though, about policymaking in the White House?
I think I just answered that question, didn't I? It's just like the time right after the horrific Parkland shootings at Parkland High School in Florida, and the president holds an event at the White House, and he says, "Well, you're not going to stand up to the NRA, but I'll stand up to the NRA." And somehow everything seemed to be, wow, the president really gets it. And then 2 seconds later, he's having dinner with the head of the NRA and said, I really didn't mean what I said before. So it doesn't seem to, it's just such a back and forth changing of minds of the president. And basically, you know, if you watch Sarah Huckabee Sanders and others like that, they just seem to have to conform to whatever mood the president is at any given moment.
It's like the policies are made by throwing darts at a dartboard by somebody who's not very good at darts. So on any given day, you're going to get one answer or you're going to get something that's almost completely the opposite.
So let's talk about the midterms, because there were midterm elections this past Tuesday. Of course, the race that everybody's looking at is the race in New York City, the 14th district, Eastern Bronx, Queens, Central Queens, where an upstart, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, overturned a 10-term Democrat, Joe Crowley, who is sort of number four in the House leadership. What does this tell us? I mean, how important is she worked for Bernie Sanders, depending on how you read it. She's a Democratic Socialist. So what does this tell us? David?
I'm sorry.
It tells us a couple of things. I mean, first of all, the greatest strength that House members have is that no one gives them a serious challenge. You know, I mean, what keeps them in their seats the longest is simply indifference to them. And so I think, you know, part of the message here, and it's the same thing that brought down Eric Cantor, you know, the Republican leader a couple cycles ago, is you know, these people actually can be challenged under the right circumstances. And being in leadership is not a a force field that keeps you safe. You know, I think that's number one. Number two is this is a candidate who looks and sounds like the modern Democratic Party and especially the modern urban Democratic Party. And, you know, this isn't the era of Frank Skeffington anymore. You know, the Democratic Party is going to have to respond to where its energy and where its base is. And, you know, some members can make that transition and speak the language and hold the line. But if more candidates like this challenged Democratic House members, we'd see a lot more of these results.
Ken, what do you think? And you're up there. Is there any chance that – I mean, this is a Democratic district because I looked at it presidential candidates won this solidly 70-80%. Is she essentially going to win in November now?
Oh, there's absolutely no question about that. And I'm glad that David brought up Eric Cantor, because when Eric Cantor lost his Republican primary to Dave Brat, I mean, basically it showed how angry the Republican right-wing base was with its leadership. Eric Cantor was the majority leader thinking of national stuff, and basically the Dave Brat argument was he was ignoring the local constituents in Virginia. And that's basically what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did against Joe Crowley. She said that that Crowley was thinking of replacing or even challenging Nancy Pelosi to be the next speaker. He was looking nationally. He was campaigning around the country on behalf of other Democrats. And she was saying, it's kind of an odd district. Crowley is from Queens. She's from the Bronx part of the district. And she was knocking on doors and said, Joe Crowley has never come here. He's never campaigned here. And he also made the terrible mistake of skipping a debate and putting in a Latina who looked like Ocasio-Cortez as in his stead as a replacement, which was kind of insulting. So there is serious. We always talk about the chasms in the Republican Party. We saw that a few weeks ago when Mark Sanford lost his primary in South Carolina because he wasn't pro-Trump enough. But there is serious disagreements and differences in the Democratic caucus. You have Nancy Pelosi, who is 78 years old. Her number two is Denny Steny Hoyer, who's 79 years old. And here you have this woman who's a bartender until recently. She's 28 years old and says, I'm angry, and there's the income inequality, and they're building, you know, New York City is building these great tall buildings, and so many of us can't get jobs. So she is talking to the disaffected, unappreciated, often ignored constituency. Now, does that sell in Iowa or Wisconsin or Florida? Who knows? I mean, who knows? But it certainly caught people like Joe Crowley with all his number four in the hierarchy and all his national prominence, caught him unawares.
And in reality, this vote wasn't that close.
It wasn't close. Ken, you mentioned Mark Sanford. Another example where the incumbent doesn't take the challenger seriously. And Sanford almost didn't campaign at all. And surely Crowley did not imagine his political career was on the line. And that's the great strength in these David versus Goliath campaigns, that, you know, one side laughs it off while the other side works morning, noon, and night. And every once in a while you see one of these. I think this one is indicative of something a little bit larger. And, you know, were younger candidates to be motivated to take on Democratic incumbents, you'll see some of these upsets. And again, more women running for office than ever before, mostly obviously on the Democratic side. And you see part of that happening here.
Yeah, I agree completely. I don't know if this if she's the kind of candidate who could be translatable around the rest of the country, but it does send a signal that there is disaffection in the Democratic Party with its leadership, with the fact that it's been in the minority, party since the 2010 elections, and I think they want more activism. And it was interesting that Crowley, during the debate, talked a lot about Donald Trump, and we have to stop Donald Trump, and we have to regain control of Congress. And whereas Ocasio-Cortez, I don't think even mentioned Donald Trump's name. She said, we need jobs, we need equality, we need better paying, higher wages. And so maybe that is the message the Democrats need in 2018 and beyond.
Just to broaden this out a bit, and Ken, start with you. Establishment Democrats have won in lots of places in the primaries. So what do you see, any other signs here from the Tuesday primaries that you want to point to that you think tells us something?
Well, I agree with you. The Democratic establishment is doing fine. Thank you very much. Crowley is the first. Look, there's only been three members of Congress defeated in the primary so far. It was Mark Sanford. It was Joe Crowley, and a third candidate, Robert Pittenger of North Carolina. So it's not that it's not a big anti-establishment fervor going around the country. But one thing I also take from Tuesday, and I know that Mitt Romney at 71 years old is not going to be leading the revolution against President Trump, but he's the kind of Republican I'd like to see what happens to him. He's obviously going to be the next senator in Utah. Orrin Hatch is retiring after 75 terms. He's been in the Senate since 1066. But the fact is that Romney, having said what he said about Donald Trump in the past, he could be the new, I don't know if he's going to be the new Jeff Flake or the new John McCain, but somebody who might keep Donald Trump, maybe remind Republicans the kind of philosophy they used to believe in, like, you know, free trade and things like that, and keeping your word.
Well,
so it'll be interesting to see what Trump, what Romney and others do.
President Trump has assured Americans that the nuclear threat from North Korea is over. But this week, intelligence photos documented that North Korea is strengthening its nuclear research facility. John Bolton has arranged a meeting between President Trump and Vladimir Putin. And the economic fallout of the budding trade war is becoming evident. What are the political ramifications? To discuss these international issues, we are joined by political junkie Ken Rudin and UC political scientist David Niven. You can join our discussion by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. So I said I was going to start with trade, but I'm not. I was wrong. I want to start with North Korea. And David, you know, here we've got sort of the White House analysis of what happened with the meeting with Kim Jong-un and that this has taken care of it. And on the other hand, we've got these photos coming out, and all of this is on the eve of a meeting with Vladimir Putin. So what does this what does this tell us about how we're conducting foreign affairs?
Well, first of all, I don't even know why we're discussing this when the real threat is Canada.
And they burnt the White House in 1812. Oh, no, they didn't. I'm sorry.
You know, I think, I mean, part of what this tells us is the whole Trump philosophy, the whole premise of his candidacy and leadership is, well, this is easy. I make deals. And nowhere in there is there necessarily any, you know, core purpose. Is it, you know, deals for what? Deals to accomplish? I make deals. Deals are made. And so you see this kind of, you know, schizophrenic, you know, relationship with foreign countries that it's hard to identify what American purpose is being advanced or what legitimate verifiable outcome is being accomplished here. But it's very easy to see deals have been made. Deals have been made. Meetings have been had. Photos have been taken. You know, that seems to be the operating premise. And it ties in, you know, with the other topics you mentioned, including trade, where the underlying purpose gets very, very muddy. But the fact that something is happening is meant to be crystal clear to you.
Ken, what do you want to weigh in on?
David's great joke about Canada. I mean, it absolutely rings true when you think of the president coming away from his summit with Kim Jong-un, and who basically said that everything was great, that we got a lot out of it. I'm not sure what they got out of it. The fact that they're continuing to build nuclear stuff, but I mean, to embrace Kim Jong-un and then to attack the Prime Minister of Canada is just remarkable. And there seems to be a certain affinity that the president has towards authoritarian figures, whether it's in North Korea or Turkey or the Philippines. And yet it's democratic allies that the president seems to have the most contempt for. And that is nerve-wracking, given the fact that we're heading towards, or he is heading towards, this summit with Putin in Helsinki in July. And I mean, you know, remember the last time the president had a meeting with NATO, he was basically accusing them of failing to, you know, pay their dues.
Well,
and the last time he met, with the gang of seven, he was berating them for not including Russia. So he has this this tendency of attacking and berating our allies while supporting the Putins of the world, and that is very disturbing and disconcerting to U.S. allies.
Well, in fact, looking ahead to the Trump-Putin summit on July 16th in Helsinki, before that takes place, he's going to be at a NATO meeting. And, you know, if I think it's fair to say that if there's anything that is in Putin's self-interest is to see the United States get split from NATO, or the United States to split from NATO, or NATO itself being weakened in some way. So, I mean, I just think, you know, the agenda for this summit coming right on the heels of NATO, and given if there's anything similar to what happened at the Group of Seven of attacking our friends, our allies, it sets up a very funny dynamic here. Seriously.
And NATO members are frightened of that. Of course, and this will be a real Trump-Putin collusion. Of course, Robert Mueller, we'll see if there's another one as well. But the fact that it comes right after the NATO meeting. So what if the NATO meeting ends in disruption or disagreement? That's great for Putin, as you point out, and also further makes the American allies wonder what Trump is up to.
David, are you clear on what the agenda is for this upcoming meeting with Putin?
Well, I don't know that anyone is clear what the agenda is. You know, I think
that's why I'm asking.
Right. I mean, part of the magic of American politics, to use a ridiculously inappropriate word right now. You know, let's take American public opinion on Vladimir Putin. And you go back 2015 among Republicans, and what's the response to Vladimir Putin? And the response is, it might not quite be Hitler, but he's in Hitler neighborhood in terms of public approval. And over the course of the Trump campaign, you kept seeing that Putin's numbers move up among Republicans until he's past the midway point to, he seems like a pretty acceptable guy. So other than rehabilitating the Vladimir Putin image among Republican voters, what is the clear objective of these years of talking about him and presenting him as an acceptable, you know, world leader? It's hard for us to discern from the outside, but it's a clear consequence, and it's the part where, you know, observers have to be baffled. You say, well, isn't this what the Republican Party has stood for generations, is standing tough against, you know, the dictators of the world.
70 years.
Exactly. And the evil empire. This is still the same people. They're still the same. And, you know, there's so much, you know, superficial admiration of Ronald Reagan and as this, you know, demigod of Republican leaders. And yet the party is now unrecognizable on these matters. And that's where the question is. What is the core? What is the point?
Well, in fact, reading about this summit as much as I could, since it's pretty unclear, one of the things that was named by an official in the administration was that on the agenda would be arms control and disarmament. And of course, Ronald Reagan worked on that his entire 8 years and worked very systematically. I don't know where we are on that at this point. I mean, it's like fallen off the agenda, and I don't see how we just put it back on and get any place.
Well, that's right. Where is it on the agenda, and what would the objective even be if it was on the agenda? Would it be the end of the agreements, and let's go free for all?
Ken, what do you think?
You know, I was just listening to what David was thinking, and I was thinking back to the 2012 debates between Mitt Romney mm-hmm. and President Obama. And Mitt Romney basically said that one of the biggest geopolitical foe the United States has is Russia. And Obama is the one who mocked him, saying that the Cold War called and it's looking for Mitt Romney. But it was funny. That's the last time I can remember where the Republican Party stood up to Russia as this enemy. And of course, the president at the time, who was a Democrat, Barack Obama, kind of mocked Romney for that. But Romney seems more prescient than ever.
you know, with it, let's shift over here to tariffs. You know, tariffs against the EU, against Canada, against Mexico, against China. And the ones against China are a little bit different. One theory is that all of these, though, are negotiating chips. It's sort of what David was saying before. It's you get into a negotiation, you have something happen, and that they all can be pulled back off the table. But do you detect any real negotiations going on with the EU, with Canada? I mean, there's the NAFTA stuff going on, but I'm not sure where that stands. Where do we stand on that, Ken?
Well, we did see negotiations with South Korea that South Korea did offer a bunch of concessions. And of course, President Trump likes whenever a negotiation ends in concessions. So we admired that. But the fact that Canada, the EU, and Mexico and others will stand up to not only stand up to U.S. tariffs, but you have tariffs of their own. The president feels that's war. This means war, and the rhetoric and the anger and the bellicosity seems to increase. I mean, just look at it. One of the reasons the president went to Wisconsin this week is basically to calm people down over Harley Davidson, who is suffering among the industries, along with pork producers and grain producers and corn producers. I mean, Harley Davidson is suffering from problems of the tariffs. And they're talking about sending some of their manufacturing overseas to avoid those kind of tariffs. So for all the strong talk about free trade, and the president has been very consistent on that, even before he was a candidate, he's always felt that China, especially China, but the rest of the world, take advantage of the United States. It seems clear that this strong policy could have the possibility of backfiring on the Republican Party and the United States, but especially the Republican Party with the midterm elections just a couple of months away.
On that Harley Davidson situation, the president has said that he will tax them as never before. Not sure what that means. I think it may mean if they're building Harley Davidsons in Europe and then bringing them back into the United States. But I don't think that's what they're talking about. I don't know how else he can tax a particular company. David?
Well, let me offer an understatement here, which is that Trump is not someone overburdened by the nuances of policymaking. And, you know, when he declares, whether it's Harley Davidson or the Amazon company, you know, when he declares a company not to be acting in whether it's the Trump interest or the American interest or his melding of the two, you know, he goes after them. He goes after them in rhetoric. And, you know, the curious part of all this, he was talking this week about the scourge of German automakers and you know, what awful people they are. Well, it works out, of course. BMW's largest plant in the world is in the United States. You can attack these companies, but they're also sources of American jobs and American wealth. So
significant jobs
that would devastate the loss of these jobs would devastate regional economies and devastate your base. And yet, again, those nuances get lost as he understands trade, or at least as he discusses it.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has said that 700,000 American jobs are in danger right now, given what has been done already. And if NAFTA is ended, 2.6 million American jobs are in danger of disappearing. Companies... there's this mid-continent nail company, the largest nail manufacturer in the United States, has said it's going to close by Labor Day unless it can get an exemption from the tariffs. And, you know, what does this have to do? That the district that mid-continent nail exists in voted 80% for Trump. So what is the political fallout of this kind of thing?
Well, I mean, of course, it remains to be seen, but that's the question we've been asking all along, that for all the tough talk and all the stuff about stopping ZTE and the Chinese companies and all the things, you know, the president has backed down on so many of the things. But again, it's American manufacturers who are going to pay the price, and American consumers will pay the price. And you know, it's one of those dumbfounded reactions I get about so many of the things of the policies of the seems narrow-minded policies of the Trump administration, that while it's tough talk against, alleged adversaries. It's the American people, the American consumers that, who suffer. So I don't know what to make of it. You still look at his numbers. He's still the most popular Republican in the history of the Republican Party, at least among Republican voters. Certainly the most popular since Bush and 9/11. And for all the wagging of the fingers and the shake and rolling of the eyes that seems to be going on in response to his policies, his base stays close. His base stays supportive. And until there's any indication where he's going to pay a political price, as we saw with the migrants and the children, you know, the separation, he's not going to change course.
Yeah. So, you know, this whole tariff trade thing, you know, it's baffling to me. I mean, Senator Portman here from Ohio used to be the trade representative for the United States. And, you know, I just don't understand the lack of Republicans who have stood for policies, worked on policies that are very different than what this administration stands for, that just don't have anything to say about this. And I am confused.
Let me give you an answer. Let me give you a reason. Let me give you an answer. Let me give you a two-word answer. Mark Sanford.
Okay. So protecting their...
That was pretty astute, wasn't it? No, but I mean, you have somebody like Mark Sanford, who has been a critic, a Trump critic from day one, very, very conservative, but critic of the fact that Trump has really, you know, has nothing to do with conservative philosophy and a true conservative. And yet, when Trump and others make the case that he's not loyal enough, sufficiently loyal, he pays the price. The reason Jeff Flake is leaving the Senate is because his attacks on Trump have alienated Trump supporters that he couldn't get renominated, let alone reelected in Arizona. So we always talk about why aren't these Republicans speaking out, and it's really hurting the American people. Where are the Republicans when we need them? And the answer is, you know, that you criticize Trump at your own political peril.
Yeah, but, you know, if a six-year Senate term, and Rob Portman's got a lot of years left on that, you know, if that doesn't embolden you at all, you know, then it really does call into question the design of the whole system here. I mean, if that doesn't reacquaint you with the basic values that you ran on, this is a way bigger problem than a handful of very quiet Republican senators.
I agree completely. And look at Susan Collins. All the thing, mm-hmm. all the big talk that we always hear from Susan Collins, that she believes in this and believes in that and stands up. And ultimately, and we've seen this in so many issues, many of these so-called moderate Republicans in the end cave.
Well, I could go to the budget, which the Congressional Budget Office issued this week a judgment about the $1 trillion deficits we're going to face in the next 10 years, but we're run out of time.
What's $1 trillion here?
What's $1 trillion? That's right. I saved it to the end, Ken. Ken, thank you, as always, for joining us and having a great question. And David Niven, thank you. It's great to have you here today. You've been listening to Cincinnati
Thanks,
Edition
guys.
On 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Our intern is Layla Shakui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.